Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm Hala Gores, and with me in the studio here at KBOO Community Radio is Will Seaman. Good morning, Will.
Good morning. This morning we have a very special guest, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. He is Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative and a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council.
Dr. Barghouti is a physician and one of the most prominent leaders in the Palestinian struggle. He is the international spokesman for the Palestinian NGO sector and organizer of international solidarity presence in the occupied Palestinian territories.
Dr. Barghouti writes extensively for local and international audiences on civil society, democracy issues, and the political situation in Palestine, and on health development policy for Palestinians living under occupation.
In addition, Dr. Barghouti is president of the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Committees, an NGO that provides health and community services to more than 1 million people annually in the occupied territories. He also serves as director of the Health Development Information and Policy Institute, an independent Ramallah-based think tank specializing in policy research and planning for the Palestinian healthcare system in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
And Dr. Barghouti was a candidate for the president of the Palestinian National Authority in 2005, garnering 19% of the vote. He's on the phone with us from the West Bank city of Hebron. Dr. Barghouti, thank you so much for joining us this morning on One Land, Many Voices.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you. Thank you.
Dr. Barghouti, we hope to talk with you about your impressions of renewed U.S. policy initiatives in Palestine and the Middle East. But we'd like to start with your recent essay, which ran in the Cairo Weekly Al-Ahram earlier this week. The title is What We Palestinians Need. In your essay, you provide an outline for a strategy to win Palestinian self-determination and an end to the Israeli occupation. Before we get into the details of that strategy, what prompted you to write the essay?
Well, I think the main reason why I felt I should write this essay is the feeling that a lot of people are confused about what's going on here. And from time to time, I have the urge that to write some kind of clarification notes about the situation. And that's how I felt after Oslo Agreement. That's how I felt about a few years ago when we were standing at a crossroad. And today I think we are standing at a crossroad. And I feel that not only the Palestinian real narrative about reality is not known to the world, I also felt that even many Palestinians are facing difficulty or having difficulty understanding the reality and the situation. And that's why I thought that such an effort might be helpful in clarifying the picture. And most important, in clarifying what kind of unified strategy we need as Palestinians.
And you describe this unified national strategy founded on four pillars. I hope we can talk about all four of those elements this morning. You start with resistance, and you write, resistance in all its forms is an internationally sanctioned right of the Palestinian people. Can you explain what you have in mind when you advocate resistance as part of this struggle?
The international law says that any people who are oppressed or occupied, as we are, or deprived from their basic right for freedom, have the right to resist injustice and struggle for their rights. And that's exactly what I mean. Struggling with great respect to international law and international humanitarian law, which means we can practice any form of struggle without, for instance, hurting or attacking civilians. At the same time, I'm proposing that under the circumstances and given the particular historical context in which we live, I'm proposing popular nonviolent form of resistance as the best form and the most effective one. Basically because Israel represents the very large military power. It is Israel that is always trying to drag us into military confrontation, knowing very well that it will win such confrontation. And it is Israel that is practicing all forms of violence. And in my belief, that under the circumstances, the most effective way, which we tried in the First Intifada, is the way that Martin Luther King used in the United States, in the civil disobedience, and the same way that Gandhi experienced in India and Nelson Mandela in South Africa. It doesn't mean, that doesn't mean you are being just pacific. No, it means you are practicing a certain form of struggle, maintaining your dignity, integrity, and maintaining your insistence on your principles, and then at the same time resist with the utmost possible firm will the Israeli occupiers' measures and the measures of apartheid and racism and discrimination that are practiced against the Palestinian population.
We are talking to Dr. Mustafa Barghouti this morning on One Land, Many Voices. Dr. Barghouti, the next key element of the strategy you wrote about is supporting national steadfastness. This is something that I think is not well known or understood here in the U.S., but has a very clear meaning for Palestinians in the occupied territories. Can you explain the role of steadfastness or sumud in this struggle?
Since 1948, since more than 61 years, the Israeli policy has been to push Palestinians out of their country through terror, through massacres, which were very well described by a fantastic Israeli historian, Ilan Pape, who wrote a very good book that I advise everybody to read, who's interested in the question at least. The book is called Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. And he described how terror was used by Israeli troops and gangs to terrorize Palestinians and force them out of Palestine. Later, the Israeli occupying force has been trying to put Palestinians under very difficult economic, social, and political conditions so that they would leave their country. Practically, this led to the creation of a severe discriminatory system. Much worse, as my friend Ron Kassler, who is a Jewish, an ex-Jewish minister in the South African government, much worse system of apartheid than the one that prevailed in South Africa. And their main aim is to push us out of our country. My goal is to have people stay in their homeland, survive the difficulties, survive the checkpoints, which is making our life a big hell, survive the orders of land confiscation and settlement expansion and demolishing of people's houses like is happening today in Jerusalem. Today I was in Jerusalem and I saw how many families were evicted from their homes illegally. The homes they lived in for more than 40 years, they were pushed out of these homes and replaced with Israeli illegal settlers in East Jerusalem. I believe that supporting these people in the area of health, education, human needs is very essential so that they can survive and stay. Because at the end of the day, we have to stay and then struggle for equality. At the end of the day, there will be no justice here and as long as we are not accepted as equal citizens and as equal human beings.
Dr. Barghouti, the third element is probably more the third element of the four pillars that you describe as a unified national strategy is probably more clearly understood, and that's the call for national unity and unified leadership. What are the challenges that face Palestinians today on this front, and what ideas do you offer for bringing about greater unity in the leadership for the Palestinian liberation?
The most difficult issue here is the division between Hamas and Fatah. And that division that has been fed by external pressure, a division that has hurt us and our democracy a great deal, and a division that is causing us a lot of internal bleeding, and that has led to great dissatisfaction of the Palestinian population. One very important challenge here is that both Hamas and Fatah struggle for an authority that really does not exist, because the authority is an authority without authority. It's an authority under military occupation. And what we're trying to say is what we need is a unified leadership of our national liberation struggle. We're not yet in the stage of competing for positions in a state apparatus since we still don't have a state. We believe that differences have to be resolved democratically in a nonviolent manner, and that at the end of the day, whatever people decide through democratic choice or elections has to be respected, which was not the case in the last elections. That's why we believe that we will never advance in our struggle properly and achieve our goal of freedom unless we are unified, unless we manage to present the world with a unified leadership, with a unified voice. We can have differences. There is nothing wrong about that. We can have pluralism is a basic element of democracy. But the issue here is about how do you choose the line when you have different opinions. And in my opinion, the best way is through democratic choice and giving people the right to choose and giving people this right regularly through regular democratic elections. I believe this mix between democracy and respect of pluralism should lead to a unified strategy where everybody will stick to that strategy, whether it comes to political negotiations or the form of struggle we should conduct. But time has come for us to be unified, and in this terrible division, from which Israel and the Israeli occupation is benefiting a lot.
Dr. Barghouti, before we move on to the fourth element, if I could have you address this a little bit further in terms of what changes have occurred more recently in terms of the new elections in the West Bank, whether Hamas has changed over the last 2 years, if you can give us some analysis of this unification or lack of unification.
Well, I believe we had elections. Hamas won. Then we had a very important development, which is something I participated intensively in, and that is the formation of national unity government. That included 96% of the representatives of the people who were elected by the public. And that national unity government, in my opinion, was unifying, was democratic. You couldn't go more democratic than that. And in my opinion, that national unity government was the best formula. Unfortunately, that government lasted only for 3 months because the Israeli government and the international community, unfortunately, maintained the siege over the government, kept the government without any income, and gradually the government collapsed, and that led to the division between Fatah and Hamas and the division between West Bank and Gaza. In my opinion, probably every side now realizes that no single party can lead Palestine. No single party can lead the West Bank alone, or no single party can lead the Gaza alone. We have to end this division. And I hope, my hope is that after lots of suffering, people will come to the wisdom of the necessity of forming this unity as soon as possible.
Well, let's go ahead and move on to the fourth element, which is clearly the most relevant for us here in the U.S. and for solidarity movement internationally. You call for building and enhancing international pro-Palestinian solidarity movement in combination with the drive to impose sanctions on Israel. Dr. Barghouti, what is needed to make the solidarity movement more effective in bringing an end to the occupation?
First of all, we need to present the right narrative to the public, and that requires entering and the media and allowing through the media people to see the reality. I think, for instance, the American public is entitled to knowing the truth. This truth is hidden from the American public. It is very rare when you have occasions like the most recent very good 60 Minutes program on CBS, which revealed, in my opinion, in 20 minutes, a lot of the substance of the reality in Palestine and how Israeli illegal settlers are destroying any chance for peace. What we need is to bring narrative to people, the true narrative, and that requires a lot of good grassroots work. But also, I think, given the situation where Israel is the fourth largest military power probably in the world, where Israel is the fourth largest military exporter, it has 400 nuclear heads, it has an overwhelming military power, which cannot be matched at all. And at the same time, it is practicing terrible violence, including killing people, when we have nonviolent protests and demonstrations. Under the circumstances, the change and the solution will not happen because of the internal balance of forces. It has the international factor is a very important one, especially that Israel is totally dependent on external aid, especially from the United States. Israel receives more than 40% of all American aid worldwide. Although Israel is an advanced industrial country, and it's not eligible for development aid in according to world standard. Nevertheless, it is receiving more than 40% of taxpayers, American taxpayers' money, which goes in the form of aid. Israel is receiving a lot of financial aid through different also associations, Jewish organizations, and so on. And Israel has the advantage of obtaining the American military technology and the right to export it at a cheaper price and better conditions, which makes Israel now, as I said, the fourth largest military exporter in the world, profiting in an amount of almost $6 billion every year. With such a situation, it is difficult for us alone to solve the problem. Our situation is very much like the situation of the African people in South Africa when they were struggling against apartheid. And then the only way to break apartheid system was to impose sanctions on the apartheid regime. And that's what we are demanding in our case. I have a very good Israeli friend. His name is Niv Gordon, who's a professor at Ben-Gurion University in Israel. And he wrote a very good article in which he demanded, it was published in the Washington Post, I think, and he demanded that the world community should immediately start sanctioning Israel and imposing punishment actions against Israel to save not only Palestinians, but also Israelis from the apartheid system that was created.
Dr. Barghouti, I know our time is limited, and I want to get to the closing part of your essay, in which you set aside a fair bit of space to address the subject of the one-state or two-state solution. And I was wondering, why did you feel it was important to address this question, and how do you think we can best approach the question of what we're ultimately working towards as a just resolution to this conflict?
I thought we should address it for two reasons. First of all, because the people every day witness the Israeli destruction of the potential for two-state solution through unlimited settlement expansion, whether in the West Bank or in Jerusalem itself, and through the Pantustanization of the West Bank and the confiscation of land and the creation of irreversible facts on the ground. So many people who believed in two-state solution now look on the ground and see that Israel is transforming the idea of two states into an idea of Pantustans, of Palestinians living as slaves of occupation and apartheid under the system of occupation, within something like a municipality regime that functions inside the prisons or clusters of prisons. And then they are ready to call it a state. But that's not a state. A state cannot be a state without sovereignty, without control of borders, without free trade, without free economy. And that's why many people now see that the idea of two states is vanishing. On the other hand, there is also Palestinians originally, I mean a long time ago, were calling for one democratic state where all people, Palestinians and Jewish people, would live equally, with equal rights and equal duties. And when we see that Israel is destroying the two states option, of course people think we have to find an alternative. We cannot accept enslavement and apartheid and racism as a solution. And that solution in this case is one-state solution. In my opinion, I am not against two-state solution if the Palestinian state is a real sovereign one and if we have the right for democracy and if Palestinian rights of refugees, Palestinian refugee rights will be guaranteed also. But if Israel kills that option, a one-state solution is good as well. The issue here is that Israel is refusing both options, and they want to keep us under enslavement and apartheid. And that's why I say at this time both solutions are acceptable, but this is not the time to divide Palestinians again one more time between those who want two states and those who want one state. I think both of us, all the people, want freedom, whether in two-state solution or in one-state solution. Probably. With the continuation of Israeli measures, and if the international community, and especially the United States, does not interfere immediately, then probably the two-state option will die, in which case the only solution will be one-state solution. But whether we are talking about two states or one state, we should not divide our ranks. And in both cases, whether we want to go ahead for two states or one state, in both cases, we should work for ending apartheid. That road to two states or one state solution goes through defeating apartheid, Israeli apartheid system, and that's what I call for now, a unifying strategy to defeat apartheid, and then we'll see what will come out.
Dr. Barghouti, as if to exemplify this idea that you talk about in terms of division in the ranks, when you talk about if Israel kills the two-state solution, isn't the two-state solution already dead with the hundreds of thousands of settlers inside of the West Bank, with the wall snaking through, separating Palestinian from Palestinian land, Palestinian farmers from their land? Isn't the two-state solution dead?
It could be dead. I don't know. Maybe it's dead yesterday. Maybe it's dead tomorrow. I don't know. I know one thing. If Israel is not forced to remove the settlements, if Israel is not forced to remove the wall, if Israel is not forced to end occupation, including to East Jerusalem, there can be no two-state solution. And then the only solution left will be one state.
Dr. Barghouti, go ahead, sorry.
No, but what is clear to me is that no solution will be there, no freedom can be there without ending apartheid. What we live in now today is a serious apartheid discrimination system.
Dr. Barghouti, do you have time to stay with us and talk to us about the Obama administration's attempts to restart peace negotiations?
Unfortunately not, because, you know, it's Ramadan and I have to join my group. They're waiting for me.
Kul aam wa antum bkhair.
All right.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mustafa
Thank
Barghouti.
And I wish you the best of luck. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, and thank you, our listeners, for being patient. We know we do have a few phone calls on the line, which we'll go to in just a few moments. We've been speaking with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, a very special guest, speaking to us live from Hebron in the West Bank.
Actually, before we move on to our callers, I think there was a great deal that we didn't talk about with Dr. Barghouti, and it is our hope that we will be able to, after Ramadan, to get him back on as a guest, because he is a fresh voice from the occupied territories, having won about 20% of the vote against Mahmoud Abbas. You can see that the Palestinians in the occupied territories are showing the world, certainly the Arab world, what democracy should look like.
And I also want to mention that this Dr. Barghouti mentioned the op-ed by Neve Gordon that ran in the Los Angeles Times. Actually, you can find it online, I'm sure, where Neve Gordon, a very important Israeli voice on these issues, came out in very strong support of the divestment, sanctions, boycott campaign. And also, I want to mention that the that article ran in the Al-Aram Weekly. This is what We Palestinians Need by Mustafa Barghouti, and that's also available online, and we'll try to track down a website for that.
Well, let's go ahead and talk to our first caller. Go ahead, caller. Good morning.
Good morning, Hala. This is Kamal Hassan, and you know I'm a Palestinian refugee in Lebanon. What I wanted to ask Barghouti, first of all, I have a couple of issues. Why is it taking so long for the Gaza siege to be lifted? We have people dying on a daily basis. The second one is all these 11,000 Palestinian prisoners rotting in jail. And the last one is I wanted to see his views on the right of return, because as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's the beating heart of the Palestinian body. So unfortunately, he had to go. Maybe you can elaborate on that.
You know, Kamal, you're absolutely right. I wish we would have had more time with him, and that's why we hope to be able to get him back on the program. The right of return for Palestinian refugees to their homes is a right that they have under international law. It is a right that is deeply entrenched in what is moral and what is right for those who were ethnically cleansed. There is a book by the name of Salman Abu Sitti, in which Dr. Abu Sitti describes how there is sufficient land inside of the Green Line for all of those refugees to return. It is a book that is worth reading. You'll be able to find it online. With respect to the 11,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, you know, Gilad Shalit's mother yesterday spoke about those prisoners, interestingly enough. She talked about not only her pain, but she talked about the Palestinian prisoners who are not with their families. So I think that you're absolutely right to bring that up. Will, did you want to add to that?
Just that for our listeners, if you're not familiar, Gilad Shalit is the Israeli soldier who was taken prisoner approximately 3 years ago in Gaza. And it was his mother speaking, and I think to everybody's you know, relief, she also addressed the issue of Palestinian political prisoners, many thousands, as our caller has pointed out. I also want to just make sure everyone knows that it's the August 13th to the 19th issue of Al Aram Weekly, which the Barghouti op-ed ran in. And I also have to mention that you're listening to One Land, Many Voices, and you're tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. And of course, you can also listen online, streaming audio at KBOO's website, www.kboo.fm.
You know, the siege of the Palestinian people in Gaza is criminal. And it is shocking that they are the forgotten Palestinians. You know, we used to refer to the refugees, the Palestinian refugees, as the forgotten Palestinians. With respect to what's happening in Gaza today, they are the forgotten Palestinians. They are starved. They are, you know, in a huge prison. They have not enough food. They're malnourished. Will, why do you think that the world can just turn its back on Gaza and get away with it?
Well, I mean, as I think the same motivation for our program provides that explanation. That is that unlike other very deserving human rights issues in the world, such as Darfur and the Sudan and Tibet, the Western media has simply ignored Gaza. Only when it explodes, only when we hear of violence that is, for example, hurting Israelis, which, of course, the missiles that targeted civilian Israeli settlements or cities ought to be in the news. But the slow torture and death and starvation, the stunting of the development of a generation of Gazan children, that should be headlines every single day because it is an ongoing catastrophe for the Palestinian people in Gaza. I want to make sure that people know that they can join this conversation today, this morning. We have another half hour of our program. We're opening it up to calls, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, if you'd like to take part in this morning's conversation.
Well, let's go ahead and continue, Will, where we were going to lead with Dr. Barghouti, which is this, you know, the appointment of George Mitchell as envoy, U.S. special envoy, to work on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Are you at all optimistic in terms of what you're hearing lately?
Well, the news reports in recent days have been emphasizing at least the picture that the Obama administration seems to be promoting right now, which is we're on the verge of a breakthrough. There's going to be a meeting between Netanyahu and Abbas, and this is going to be the beginning of negotiations for a final settlement. But it's very difficult to be optimistic, especially when you see juxtaposed with those reports. Reports, for example, in Haaretz, which talked about one of the key sticking points. There were a number of news reports about the Obama administration pressuring the Netanyahu government, pressuring the Israeli government to stop the settlements, to freeze the expansion of these settlements, these illegal settlements in the West Bank. And this breakthrough was apparently the result of some kind of progress on that particular question. And yet in Haaretz, the Israeli daily newspaper, one of many, an English language daily newspaper in Israel, sort of like the New York Times, there was a headlined report saying that the Obama administration had dropped the demand regarding East Jerusalem, expansion of what are essentially settlements. What the Israeli government refuses to acknowledge are settlements. But, of course, this is a displacement of Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, generations of Palestinians living in East Jerusalem who are being thrown off their land, whose homes are being demolished. This is something the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions has been campaigning on for years and years. This process of dispossession is not something that's simply in the past. We're seeing it happen today, every day. And so in light of that, in light of the intransigence of the Israeli government on these questions of settlements, it's hard to see what has been gained, what kind of concessions might be possible. The U.S. government does not seem to be willing. It's clear it has the capacity, but it does not seem to be willing to bring the pressure to bear to stop the settlements, to bring these settlements to an end. And, of course, it's not simply a matter of stopping them. They have to be – if there's to be a viable Palestinian state on the West Bank, those settlements have to be gone. They can't just – there's discussion of land swap, but it's clear that 300,000, I think, was the number I most recently read about, illegal Israeli settlers in the West Bank. Those people can, of course, live within a Palestinian state. That's something that can be negotiated.
As citizens of Palestine.
As citizens of that new Palestinian state. But the settlements will not be part of Israel. And this is something that it's completely unclear how the Netanyahu government would ever be, unless a tremendous increase in U.S. pressure is brought to bear, would ever concede that.
Let's go ahead and take one more caller. Go ahead, caller. Good morning.
Is this my turn?
It is.
Okay. Thank you very much for the program and for having Mustafa Barghouti on. He's excellent, first rate, and by all means, get him back if you can. I want to just address perhaps a public relations issue regarding the right of return. Recently, we have heard how Israeli settlers are being allowed to drive out Palestinians from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem on the grounds, no doubt legally specious, but on the grounds that these homes were owned by Jews before 1948, and they lost them in the division of the city in 1948. Now, apparently, this is being allowed legally by the Israeli courts. Couldn't a big push be made, at least as a public relations push here in the United States, along these lines? If Jews are allowed to return to homes in East Jerusalem, which they claim they owned before 1948, then surely this opens the door to the return of Palestinians to their homes in Israel that they were driven out of in 1948. Of course, it's a quixotic move, but it seems to me it would have public relations value and show up the extreme discriminatory and racist policies of the Israeli government and the Israeli legal system.
Absolutely true. It will show the apartheid system for what it is.
Yep.
Now, there was an article written also in Haaretz that talked precisely about that.
Oh,
that
great.
if you are going to use the right of return for the Jewish families in East Jerusalem,
yeah,
then how can you not allow the right of return for Palestinians who are able to prove ownership of homes,
yeah,
in Haifa and Yaffa and Tel Aviv, etc.?
And Lud and Ramle and all the rest.
Exactly. So you bring up an excellent point, but as we know with other court opinions, the rules are applied differently to Palestinian citizens of Israel than they are to Jewish citizens,
yes,
of Israel.
We should try whatever we can to expose this. Can you tell me where, in which issue of Haaretz this was printed? Is it a recent issue or?
I can certainly look it up for you, but off of memory, it would have been approximately a month and a half to 2 months ago.
Okay.
But it's something that I will try to find, caller, and be sure to post on our website.
Okay. Thank you very much, Hal. This is Hugh calling.
Thank you, Hugh.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
And we have another caller. Caller, go ahead, please.
Yes, I heard you make mention of the stresses upon the children, I believe, in Gaza Strip with malnutrition.
Yes.
And how long has this been going on?
Many years, actually.
Well, with the dangerous area that Gaza is and the problematic circumstances of raising a family and all that, perhaps the Palestinians should stop pumping out children.
Well, I think that in any conflict zone, the idea that the people who are victim of an occupation, the idea that they should be told to stop having children, it seems to me, is this the sort of advice you'd give to Israelis as well?
Well, I don't think that we should tell them. We should give them some assistance and some counseling advice. They can do whatever they want, but perhaps they haven't been able to figure that out for themselves.
Yeah. Caller,
if I was in a war zone, I would not be having children and expect someone else to take care of them.
Yeah. Caller, if I may, the comment that you make is very racist in its nature. It blames the victim for the position that they are in because of a military occupation that is starving its children. Now, if you are willing...
Does military occupation cause them to conceive their children?
No, I think that when you talk about a military occupation that prevents medical care, that prevents food from coming in, that prevents people from freely going in and out of their areas, I think that the comment you make is a racist comment because you do not address the issue of the occupation. You want to blame the victims.
Thank you, caller. We have another caller on the line. Yes, caller.
Good morning. This is Chris Borgu. Good morning, Hala.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask you to expand on, you mentioned that the Obama administration might get the Israelis to, quote-unquote, stop settlements, and I wanted you to expand on what happens if that happens, because I read something from the Council of the National Interest basically pointing out what the American peace plan is and that it looks a lot like the Geneva Accords, which would negate many of the things that Hala and Mustafa Barghouti talk about in terms of the one state, in terms of the right of refugees to return in terms of Eastern Jerusalem.
I'm going to toss that back to you, Chris. Could you describe better what were the shortcomings of the Geneva Peace Accords? I know that this has been for quite some time, the issue of the right of return has been a key point of contention. I know one way that this is often talked about is there has to be a clear recognition of the right of return, and then some question of what is the modality that right of return is recognized.
Right.
Would it be required, for example, have unlimited return of refugees inside the Green Line? Could that be something that's negotiated in terms of a final status settlement of some sort? Or is it something that simply cannot be negotiated? It's something that either the right of return is recognized 100% universally, or there cannot be a peaceful resolution to this conflict.
Well, in my opinion, the right of return, there are certain rights that are guaranteed by a state. Like, a state can negotiate borders between one state or another. But the, as the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and as Ilan Pape, as my family personally experienced, was done at an individual level. And there are certain rights that are given to the individual, not the state government. One example I would use, for example, would be the right of intermarriage between, let's say, a black person and a white person. It used to be in certain parts of the U.S. that the overwhelming majority of both black and white people were against the notion of interracial marriage. But does that make it illegal, or is that a personal right? And so certain rights I would maintain, such as the right to return to one's home or homeland, are individual rights, and certain rights can be negotiated. Mm. And the right of return of a refugee is an individual right. Now, I wanted to point out to your listeners, who I'm sure are aware, that any Jewish person anywhere in the world can return to Israel within the Green Lines or even into the occupied territories. So what I'm calling for is equality. So does that mean the notion that all refugees would be able to return? Palestinians, yes, because I think that on the basis of equality. So when I hear Jewish people coming to live there, I say welcome home. But I don't give it, since I believe in equality, I believe that all people, regardless if they can, you know, if they're part of that country, part of their history is there, they have a right to return to their homeland just like any other person. So I would say unask the question. Don't ask whether it's you have to be Muslim or Christian or Jewish. If you have a connection to that part of the world, you have a right to be there.
Chris, if I may play devil's advocate, you know what my view is in terms of the right of return of Palestinian refugees. But if I may play devil's advocate,
okay,
what you are calling for is the death of the Israeli state. That Israel will not be a Jewish state if what you are advocating is what we end up with. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say, you know, that's a good question, and I think you're partially right. I think that if I say to you that, for example, Spain should be a Catholic state, you know, you would say, well, that's what they had during the Inquisition. If I said to you the United States should be a white Protestant state, you would say, well, you know, go join the Ku Klux Klan. Yeah, I do think that if you predicate democracy with any other people, we're only one group of people anywhere, then it's not true democracy. And yeah, I believe that even at, that Israel would not be a Jewish state had they not done the ethnic cleansing. And so they created a majority. You know, if I said to you, you know, we want to make Texas a white state, you know, to ensure that the increasing numbers of Latinos never predominate, you would say that's a racist notion.
Sure. There'd be a huge outcry.
Right. There would be a huge outcry. And so what I'm saying is that I'm not a pollutant, and no, and a Jewish person is certainly not a pollutant anywhere in the world. And so when you ask questions of because of some religion or color or orientation of a person's birth, and I know you're playing devil's advocate, and that's just the point, is that these are the questions that shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter if you're a Christian or a Muslim or a Jewish person anywhere in the world. And that's what we work for when we work for human rights, is that people have no special privileges and are denied no privileges on the basis of birth or bloodline anywhere.
We have some other callers, but I want to pursue this with one more question that I was trying to sort of allude to when we were first talking about it. This is such a key, important point, and I don't think we've really talked about it nearly enough on this program.
Okay.
But one element of any kind of negotiated settlement, some kind of settlement to this this decades-long conflict, is that each of these points of contention and disagreement have to be negotiated. There has to be some kind of process of deliberation, debate, both within the Palestinian community and then at the negotiating table with the Israelis. I'm not a part of any of those discussions from the standpoint of actually moving the ball forward in this process.
May I play devil's advocate with you, Will, for just a moment, because you did it sort of with me. And
sure,
I think,
sure.
Is you just maintain that everything must be done through negotiations at the table. And earlier today, Mustafa compared the situation in Palestine, Israel, to what happened in South Africa. And what happened in South Africa was essentially not a negotiated settlement. You know, there wasn't a negotiation, let's say, between Martin Luther King Jr. and the United States. Essentially, when people ask for their rights from an apartheid situation, isn't it just given to them? You know, it's not done through long negotiations. Human rights are not based on, you know, you can sit in the back of the bus or in the front of the bus if you give up the right to live, you know, go to the lunch counter kind of
thing. Chris, if I may, you're absolutely right. You do not negotiate people's civil rights. You do not negotiate people's human rights. So the question,
that's what I'm saying.
Sure. The question is, how do we reach a resolution?
Well, that, I mean, that's something, that's the $64,000 question, really. You know, I, as I said, to me, the Jewish residents of the State of Israel are home. But the question now is the resolution, which I think Mustafa brought up, and correctly, has to be done on the basis of equality. And I'm one of those people like Mustafa who, you know, I don't focus on one state, two states. You know, to me, you know, it's not how you cut the pie, but the quality of ingredients you use to make the pie.
Good point.
And if you use, you know, that's what I
sure. We have other callers to take.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling. Go ahead, Go ahead, our next caller, please.
Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Great show. Really interesting and really excellent questions and stuff. I live in the Salem area, and I would like to be active in this in some way. I was wondering if anyone knows of any groups or contacts in the Salem area that I could hook up with.
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are groups down in the Salem area. I'd recommend, in terms of linking up with these different groups, a couple of different organizations. Nationally, there's the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, which consists of dozens, hundreds of other organizations nationwide that are involved in this struggle. And you can get in touch with those local organizations through the U.S. Campaign's website. And I believe that's endtheoccupation.org. Also, here in Portland, Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights has a terrific website, and that's AUPHR.org. Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, AUPHR.org, which also has links to the various organizations in the whole state of Oregon. So that would be a way of getting in touch with the folks down in Salem or Corvallis or other parts of the state.
And if you really have a lot of time and energy, it would be great if Salem can start an Al-Auda, A-L-A-W-A-D-A, Al-Auda, A-L-A-W-D-A, I think, .org. This is the organization that focuses all of its efforts on the right of return of all Palestinian refugees. And that's another one that we could also put up on our website, Will, if we can, so that if folks want to start an Al-Auda chapter in Salem, in Portland, and elsewhere, that would be great. We're going to make a couple of announcements before we run out of time. Go ahead. Sorry,
Cole. How would someone get a hold of this Al-Auda? Is there a website or a contact person? Or?
Yes, there's a website. There are contact people. And if you, Will, do you have our website handy?
Yes, if you want to find our past programs, and this program will be up in the next day or two, you can go to pdxjustice.org. That's PDX as in Portland, justice as in justice and the American way, .org, pdxjustice.org, and you'll find our past programs. And with each program, we try to have links to the different topics, to resources, to find out more about the different topics that we talk about during the program. Also, our programs are available on the KABU website, KABU FM, KABU.FM, which is a terrific resource for all of the great programs that are produced here at Community Radio KBOO.
We're going to ask our callers to hold on while we make a couple of announcements. Will, what's our next announcement that's coming right up?
Well, I just want to mention something that was talked about a couple of programs ago, and that's the Long Mile. This is an international coalition plan for a nonviolent march to the Erez crossing in Gaza. You can find out more about it at www.gazafreedommarch.org. And I just want to read a little bit from this. This is really a spectacular initiative. On January 1st, 2010, the Coalition to End the Illegal Siege of Gaza will be sending people from around the world to Gaza. They will march alongside the people of Gaza to break the illegal siege. This nonviolent action draws inspiration from the rich Palestinian traditions of nonviolent resistance, as well as the Salt March of Mahatma Gandhi and the Selma March of Martin Luther King. And again, I just want to make sure our listeners know about this very exciting, quite revolutionary initiative, and you can find out more. Again, it's the Long Mile, International Coalition Plans Nonviolent March to the Erez Crossing. You can find out more at gazafreedommarch.org.
You know, for the past 3 years, I've attended a wonderful event, the American Indian Day celebration in Pioneer Square. They're having their fourth annual American Indian Day celebration September 25 from 2 to 8 p.m. in Pioneer Square. American Indian Day is a day to honor and reflect on the history and achievements of American Indians. We would like to see you there, you know, in light of the parallel histories between Palestinians and American Indians. It's a special thing for me to attend, and it would be great if you can attend also. Let's go ahead and take one more caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Hello, yeah. Will and Hala, several calls back, a male making a criticism about, I think it was about having babies in Gaza. Am I correct in what I picked
up? Yes, that's going to happen now and again.
Okay, I want to say this. I'm a woman and a mother, and I can't be intellectual about his comment. I think he's cruel, inhuman, and a creep. Thank you for your program.
And thank you for your comment. I want to mention one other event that's coming up. It's a little bit further out, October 2nd, Friday, October 2nd. There is a mobilization. It's an expanded Friday rally, 5 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square. And this is a mobilization against the ongoing war and occupation in Afghanistan. It's marking a very grim anniversary of that war, which we recall was started back in October of 2001. And it's a war that has become remarkably, at least in the Obama administration's eyes, the good war. It's the war that we should be fighting. And, of course, I think it maybe doesn't have to be said that there's a lot of dissent against that view and a lot of disappointment in the policies coming out of the new Obama administration on that front. So that's October 2nd at Pioneer Courthouse Square at 5 p.m.
You know, Will, one program we might think about in the future is focusing on the most recent Israeli elections and what that has done to Israeli society, what it has done to the so-called peace process. I'm reminded of a comment that Tzipi Livni had made. She told Israel Radio that Lieberman erased in 20 minutes years of efforts to advance the peace process. That was her view. However, under, of course, under Livni and her cohort, nothing much was happening anyway. So it's quite interesting. Do we have time to take one more caller?
We actually don't have any other callers on the line. I do want to mention, though, in light of the discussion of future programs, we, of course, want to hear from you. If you have particular guests or particular topics that you'd like us to take on here on One Land, Many Voices, you can write to us at pdxjustice@riseup.net. That's pdxjustice@riseup.net. We really would love to hear from you with your comments, with your questions, and with your suggestions for topics and guests for the program. And I also would like to mention, since we do have a little bit more time today, that our theme music is provided by the wonderful oud musician Rahim Al-Haj. We open our program with one of his songs, Dance of the Palms, and our closing music is a song called Yearning, both from the album Iraqi Music in a Time of War, available from Vox Lox documentary Sound Art. So with that, we are coming to the close of another edition of One Land, Many Voices, and we hope you've enjoyed the program, and in particular, we hope to hear from you to get your views and your comments and suggestions for future shows. There's one other announcement I'd like to make, and that is that our October program, that's again the fourth Friday in October, we do have advance notice of who our guest will be, and that's Rabbi Joey Wolf, who is going to help us to continue the discussion, which we've had on a number of occasions on this program, our discussion of Zionism. And it promises to be, I think, a very interesting, very passionate, and I hope a very informative program.
You know, Rabbi Wolf is a personal friend of mine. On some things we agree to disagree, but his heart is certainly in the right place. He's quite an amazing human being working with Rabbis for Human Rights, and I look forward to that program.
As do I. It looks like we do actually have one more caller, and we have just enough time, I think, to take them. Yes, caller, what's your comment or question?
This is Will. Hi, Hala and Will. I, in a conversation with you, Hala, a while back, I suggested possibly that there might be a negotiated equivalent right of return, whereby some Palestinians would get to return in exactly the same numbers as Jews exercise their rights of return. I've looked all over all the sources that I could find, and I don't believe anybody is discussing that option. I'd like to hear your comments.
Sure. From my perspective, I don't think that we can negotiate the right of return for people whose right is intrinsic in human rights and international law. The leaders cannot say, we will agree to return 100,000 Palestinian refugees. I think that right is there, and it cannot be negotiated. That said, you can offer possibly those who do not wish to return fair compensation. That is not something that the leaders can impose upon the people. That's my view of it. Will?
Well, I think we're at the end of our hour, and I'd like to thank all of our listeners and especially thank our callers for taking part in One Land, Many Voices this morning. Coming up on KABU is Air Cascadia and Flashpoints. And we'd like to thank you all for listening, and please tune in next month, fourth Friday of every month, 9 a.m. here on Community Radio KBOO here in Portland, Oregon, for One Land, Many Voices.